Well, hello, everybody. Good evening. I'm Martin Bandyke. I'm your morning host at Ann Arbor's 1071. And man, I'm burning the midnight oil here as a morning host, pushing the envelope, staying up past 7 p.m. Thanks for joining us every month for the Ann Arbor District Library. I record a podcast interview. It's available at aadl.org, Martin Bandyke Undercovers, where I get a chance to interview a lot of Detroit-based authors and authors actually from all around the country. A lot of music books, obviously, since I'm a music host, but I'm also kind of a sports nut, and especially baseball, and a history nut, and I love movies as well. And when I heard a few months ago this summer about this book by our guest Tom Stanton that dealt with 1930s Detroit and this incredible moment in the Detroit sports scene where Joe Louis, where the Detroit Tigers, where the Lions, where the Red Wings, where all the teams, even the Lions, were winning and during the Depression, no less. It was this time of great highs and great lows and great tragedy, like all happening at once, and it included this horrific organization called the Black Legion, which I frankly had never heard about before I read this book, Terror in the City of Champions. And our author is here tonight to give a presentation about this new book. Please welcome Tom Stanton. Tom.
Well, this is the first time I'm trying it with a PowerPoint, so we're actually going to have some pictures to look at, and I'll echo a little bit of what Martin said. The origins of this book come from my childhood when I was a sports-obsessed kid. And 11 years old in 1971-72. And my uncles, my dad grew up a large Catholic family on the east side of Detroit near the city airport. And at Christmas time, my uncles and aunts, they would all come to our house and come to the basement, you know, the Christmas lights glittering on the walls, the smell of kielbasa and kraut and lasagna wafting on the air, and they'd start reminiscing. Early 70s, if any of you, some of you are as old as I am, probably if you were sports fans, you remember it wasn't the most glorious time for our Detroit teams. We had won the World Series in 68. I was a little too young to appreciate that. We'd go back, if you were a Tiger fan, you'd be back in the playoffs in 72. But the 70 team, 71 team, kind of weak for Tigers. The Pistons weren't doing anything. The Red Wings were, you know, the final years of, well, what we thought were the final years of Gordie Howe's days. And as Martin mentioned, the Lions weren't winning, and they've never won in my lifetime, period. So, and my uncles, they would talk about this glorious time when they were coming of age, when the Tigers won the World Series in the fall of 35, and the Lions won the NFL championship a month later, and that spring, the Red Wings won their first Stanley Cup. All of these were the first championships for each one of those teams, and it was happening as Joe Louis was on the rise, the undefeated, uncrowned champion of boxing, uncrowned because he had not yet been given a shot at the title. I used to be so envious of my uncles in this time period, again, because we were suffering through something less glorious. But there was this is where the technique comes in, trying to get the coordination of these events, Tigers, Lions, Wings, and Joe Louis. But there was this one other event that my eldest uncle, my Uncle Clem, used to speak of when he'd reminisce. He was a radical in the 30s. He was an aspiring writer, and he hung out with artsy friends, and he was always protesting something. And one evening in 1936, he's walking in the Black Entertainment District of Detroit. So this is where we actually take a little segue here. This is your first chance to win a candy bar. Baby Ruth candy bars, because there are no Ty Cobb candy bars. And actually, some of you are probably familiar with the story of the Baby Ruth bar. He lost a lawsuit. He sued, came out at the right when his popularity was on the rise with the Yankees, and he saw there was a Baby Ruth bar and said, hey, that has my name on it. He sued. He lost because the candy company successfully argued that it was named for the daughter of President Cleveland, who by that point was 18 years old. So nonetheless, the Black Entertainment District in Detroit.
Paradise Valley.
So here we're going to try to throw, okay? Very good. So Paradise Valley. So my uncle's walking with one of his brothers, two of his buddies, and this car pulls up next to them, beside them. Two white guys in the car. And they start questioning, what are you doing here? Why are you here? You shouldn't be here. Get out of here. Leave. You're up to no good. And one of my uncles was a boxer, and he starts to take offense, raises his shoulder, and the situation becomes exacerbated and grows into a confrontation. The guys identify themselves as police officers, but they're not wearing any uniforms, and it's an unmarked car. And they order them in, they pull guns, and they order them into the back seat. In my uncle's retelling of this story, he thought he was heading toward his death. He thought he was going to end up in a ditch, dead, shot in the head by the infamous Black Legion, by the Knight Riders who were terrorizing Detroit at that point. It turned out they were actually cops, and my uncle spent the night in jail, but that was the first time I'd heard of the Black Legion. And over years, as I was working on other books, this is my seventh book, I would, in the old Detroit papers from the 30s, I'd see mentions of the Black Legion. And it just got to the point where I decided I wanted to dig deeper into this story. The book, it melds these two stories, two overlapping stories that are happening concurrently, one of light and one of darkness. How many of you have heard of the Black Legion prior to reading about this book? Usually when I mention that I've written a book about a gang of criminals in 1930s Detroit, people always say, Purple Gang, right? The Jewish rum-running gang. The Black Legion was a not-for-profit organization. It was a hate organization, kind of like the Klan, only more violent, and they prospered in typically industrial areas in the Midwest, especially Ohio, Michigan, and Indiana. It's estimated that their membership was in the tens of thousands, up to 100,000, maybe a little bit higher than that. And the way you would become a Black Legion member if you were a white Protestant male is that one of your friends might ask you to a barbecue, or might ask you to a card game, might invite you to get together with some other good Americans. And you go to this event, and it might be in the basement of a church, it could be at one of the Masonic temples, it could be in a field out in Romeo or Adrian or Oxford or Monroe. At some point in the evening, if you were indoors, the lights would go out, a red light would appear. Suddenly, you would find you're surrounded by guys in black robes and black hoods. The Black Legion, and they're heavily armed. And you would be told that you had heard too much information at this point to not become a member of the Black Legion. And you would take, with the gun pointed at you, you would take the oath, the black oath, agreeing that you would have your head split open, your guts spilt, if you did not agree to follow the code of the Legion, if you did not agree to do whatever your Legion boss has said, including committing crimes, if you did not agree to lie in court if necessary, or if you were to reveal that you were a member of the secret society, because it was a secret society, you could be punished by death. And so if you're like a normal person, not really embracing the hate organization, you're surrounded by armed people, your gun's pointed at you, you're told you have to take the oath of office, you probably figure, I'm going to take the oath of office rather than die here at this moment, and I just won't come to any other meetings. And so if you did that, what would happen is within a few weeks, a gang of guys, your fellow legionnaires, would show up at your porch and try to convince you that you needed to start coming to the meetings. And if you didn't, a couple weeks later, you might be dragged from your house, taken out to a field, stripped from the waist up, and each of those 13, 14 guys would take a swing at your back with a black snake whip. The Legion concerned itself with a range of crimes, from the petty to the grand. They had ambitions to possibly take over the country. They were enemies of FDR, and they frequently, the leaders frequently told their underlings that, you know, there were fewer people in, who overthrew the government, overthrew the Tsar in Russia than we have in our membership. They described themselves as being against every ism other than Americanism. So, you know, like the Klan against Negroism and Judaism and Catholicism and socialism and communism, but also, in the Legion's case, against unionism. And many of the killings that they executed, it's estimated about 50 in Southeast Michigan, according to the police captain, Michigan State police captain who investigated it, were faked to look like suicides and were not investigated deeply at the time. So, cheery story. So most of us would avoid trying to be in the Black Legion. Some folks like the idea. This is Dayton Dean. He's one of the main characters in the book. And this is a nonfiction book, so this is all based on, you know, 900 plus pages of FBI files I went through and Michigan State police files and reporting at the time. And Dayton Dean led a rather mundane life. He was a pipe wrapper at the Mysterski power plant, which still operates. Any of you familiar with Fort Wayne in Detroit? Just down the street from Fort Wayne is the Mysterski power plant. And that's where Dayton worked. He hadn't gotten beyond elementary school. And, you know, his day-to-day life was just rather boring. And so he's getting initiated, and he's loving it. This is like a movie to him. This is like a radio serial. This is an adventure. And so he throws himself into the Black Legion, rises quickly through the organization. There are about a dozen regiments in Southeast Detroit, at max about 1,600 men in each one. And he's with one of the regiments in downtown Detroit, and he's also involved in one in Highland Park. And he rises so quickly that he gets to be part of the death squad, which means he's crucial to the assassination plots against a suburban mayor in Ecorse, against a newspaper publisher in Highland Park, against a well-known labor leftist attorney in Detroit. Any of you ever heard of Maurice Sugars? The Sugar Law Center was one of the targets. And so they have grand ambitions as well as petty ones. And the grander ones are they're looking at how to poison the cheese and milk deliveries with typhoid germs to the Jewish and Black neighborhoods. They're continually bombing places and executing a whole bunch of other things. Meanwhile, this is Detroit in the Great Depression. This is about around 1933. The book starts in December of 33, goes through the spring of 1936. 1920s was a time of growth, of course, in Detroit. Most of the skyscrapers, the old ones that we know of, when you look at the downtown skyline, the Panopsk Building, the Guardian, Fisher Building, they're built in the 1920s, as was the DIA, as was the main branch of the public library, the Ambassador Bridge, the tunnel beneath the river, Olympia. And so it's a time of growth. Of course, the market crashes in 29, and Detroit suffers by 33. The unemployment rate in the city is estimated at about 45%. Incredibly difficult times. And so people are looking for ways to keep their jobs. And the Black Legion offered employment. Many of them were employed. Well, at the same time, it used to be, and still is actually, many Detroiters during bad times turned to their sports teams to lift their spirits. But in 1933, when there were bank closures in Detroit, the Tigers were doing miserably. And the attendance had plummeted beneath 4,000 per game. And the owner, Frank Navin, was looking desperately for a way to reinvigorate the team to bring people back into the seats. And at first he tried to bring Babe Ruth into Detroit to manage the team. That didn't work. Couldn't get Ruth here. The second choice was the guy you see in the upper left-hand corner. There's your second candy bar. Anybody know who that is? Mickey Cochran. I don't even know where that came from, but I'm going to... Way back there. Mickey Cochran, the star, the best catcher in baseball, the star of the Philadelphia A's, who had won the World Series for Connie Mack a couple times. He is, according to Ty Cobb, the most driven, most competitive player in baseball. And he comes to Detroit, and I don't mean this flippantly, but if they had had, you know, Xanax or other mood-altering drugs back then, he would be on them because he is a guy of extreme highs and extreme lows. And because he's the superstar, the young guys on the team, when they hear Mickey Cochran, the famous Mickey Cochran, tell them that this team has the potential to go all the way, they buy into it. The veterans, not so much. They're a little more suspicious, and they think he's playing mind games with them. But sure enough, that first year he's here, the Tigers explode in success. 1934, they're heading toward the World Series. They're winning games in a way that they hadn't in a long time, not even in the era of Ty Cobb. And the city is just going crazy. They're in love with this team. And oddly, so are the guys in the Black Legion. They're sports fans, many of them. They plan some of their crimes around the schedule of the Tigers. If we're going to beat that guy, you know, we can do it an hour and a half later and still see the game, you know, hear the game, right? Or one of their most famous murders is planned around baseball, luring somebody to his death for that reason. One of the reasons that that would be so odd for a hate group like the Klan to be rooting for the Tigers is at first base.
Hank Greenberg.
Yeah, so we got Hank Greenberg. I heard muddles of Hank Greenberg over here too. So Hank Greenberg is, if not the most famous Jewish athlete at that point, one of the other ones. Maybe the Max Baer, the boxer, is a contender. And I don't recall, and I'm sure somebody in here is going to know the name of the Jewish quarterback for the Wolverines. I don't know the answer, so.
So
I think it's Newman. I think you're right. Yeah, I think that's right. So, but Greenberg is this young, slugging first baseman for the Tigers in his early 20s, 6'4", 6'5", and he's at first base. So, and then next to him, at second base, you have my dad's idol. And my dad passed away about a year and a half ago, almost 95. And when I was growing up, this guy became an example of how to live my life. Charlie Gehringer. Before we get to Charlie was probably the third most famous Catholic in Detroit at that time. The bishop, Michael Gallagher, I would put in the top three. Frank Murphy was out of town. He was in the Philippines, the future governor and former mayor, so I'm not going to count him. But this guy was more famous than any of them, and he was broadcasting from Royal Oak, the radio priest. Yeah, so I'm not even getting hands anymore, but, you know, I do have candy bars for this. Father Coughlin. Father Coughlin has a radio audience, one of the largest in the country, of 10, 20, 30 million a week, depending on the week. His mail is so enormous that the post office creates the Royal Oak Post Office to handle it. And if you've ever been along Woodward, about 11, 12 mile there, and you see that seven-story crucifixion tower, that's built with the money of Father Coughlin. So at this point, some of you undoubtedly know who Father Coughlin is and know that by the end of the decade, he will be a raging anti-Semite and he'll be in some ways aligning himself with Hitler, unfortunately. But in 1935, 36, he's not really quite there. You're getting hints of the anti-Semitism, but it's not of the variety that he's going to have later. And so he's one of the more famous Catholics. But the third most famous is the guy in the lower corner. Somebody mentioned Charlie Gehringer. And Charlie Gehringer, when I was a kid, was my dad's favorite player. My dad, as I mentioned, grew up Catholic. His mom didn't want him playing baseball. But Charlie Gehringer was the example he could cite, because Charlie Gehringer was this devout Catholic who went to church every day. All right? And so my dad could idolize Charlie Gehringer. And so when I'm growing up, my dad's telling me, you know, the lessons of Charlie Gehringer, basically. You know, you never swing at the first pitch, which shows you the value of patience. Supposedly, Charlie didn't swing at the first pitch. Charlie spent his entire career with the Tigers, and after he was done, he went into management with the team, which showed you the value of loyalty. And then the third one, I could never really figure out why he told me this, and Charlie Gehringer never got married until he was in his 40s. And I'm not really sure what the lesson was there, but true enough, Charlie's mother had diabetes. She was ill, and he didn't think it was fair to bring another woman into that situation. So you have a Klan-like organization that hates Jews and Catholics, rooting for a team whose two main stars, two of three main stars, are a Jewish guy, a Catholic guy, and Mickey Cochran, the player manager of the team, who's their catcher. Most people assume Mickey Cochran, given his name, is Irish Catholic, and actually he's an Irish Protestant. He's a 33rd degree Mason. And he is aligned politically more with J. Edgar Hoover. And he is becoming friends that year with the guy on the right-hand side.
Harry
Bennett. Harry Bennett. One more candy bar coming back here. So Harry Bennett is Henry Ford's right-hand man. So on the right-hand, on the left-hand side, we have Henry Ford and his son Edsel. Anybody recognize the guy on the left? A huge movie star at the time, and one of the better known as a radio humorist.
Will Rogers.
Will Rogers. That's Will Rogers. They're at the 1934 World Series together. Harry Bennett is this wiry boxer guy who some of you may know labor history much better than I do, but who is the guy who's running the private police force at the Rouge plant. And he is the guy who fulfills Henry Ford's darker wishes. Depending on your viewpoint, and my uncles, most of them were union guys or radicals, they hated Harry Bennett. But I'm sure there are people out there who thought he was necessary to fulfill Henry Ford's dream of keeping the unions out of Ford. That season, 1934, Mickey Cochran and Harry Bennett are growing close. They've become such good friends that Mickey's kids will call him Uncle Harry, that that they will buy houses next to each other on Gros Isle. And I believe the mansion that Henry Ford had built for Harry Bennett still is along the Huron River here, is it? So, familiar with the house that was built here? Henry Ford funded a mansion for Harry Bennett that had gun turrets, cages for his pet lions and tigers, escape tunnels to a boathouse. Does it make sense on the Huron River? I'm not sure how much of a boat, I guess. And they even designed these concrete stairs as part of a getaway that he could flip the lights off, and if somebody's chasing him down these stairs, the stairs aren't symmetrical. They're uneven, different heights and distances, so if you don't know where the traps are, you're going to plummet as you're chasing somebody down the stairs. Anyway, Harry Bennett. Among some people, you still mention that name and it just draws a reaction. Well, Harry Bennett, some people believe, though he was never tied to it in court, is one of the guys pulling the strings behind the Black Legion. The Black Legion met at numerous places because they, even though they had many police officers who were members, the Detroit Police Force was honeycombed with Legionnaires, they still needed to hide their activities from others, from other police officers who might be Catholic and may not be accepting of what they're doing, or might just be decent guys. So one of the places where they often met on the left still stands, down at Waterman in West Lafayette in southwest Detroit. That's the old Finletter Masonic Temple. I think now it's a rental facility. The one on the right is the old stone chapel, and that was one of the bases for Dayton Dean and the squad he was involved with. That is gone, but that's over near Masonic Temple, near Cass Tech High School, near Cass Park, right on one of the corners there. And they met all sorts of other places. There would be musters on some weekends where thousands of Black Legionnaires would gather, spend the night there in campers or in tents or just in their cars, hear political speeches. This is the guy who said he was the leader of the Black Legion once it became exposed. An electrician out of Lima, Ohio. His name is Bert Effinger. When you're doing a book of this sort, you're trying to, of course, get as much information as you can. You're trying to track down family members of victims, of sports stars, of Legion members. Had next to no luck with tracking down anybody who knew Bert Effinger. Effinger's not a very common name, right? He's from Lima, Ohio. Today, there are still hundreds of Effingers in that section of Ohio. I sent letters to all of them. I Facebook friend Effingers all over the place, you know. Followed them on Twitter. Not one person would admit to knowing anything of Bert Effinger. And I suppose a lot of us wouldn't want to acknowledge if we had a grandfather or great-grandfather who was the head of a hate organization. But this is Bert Effinger. He would never go to prison. He would never be convicted. The oath of secrecy held to a good degree, not entirely. As I mentioned, in Detroit, though, and in Pontiac and in Flint, the Black Legion was used to deter the union movement. And the police, one of the things I show in the book is that the police commissioner of Detroit was a member of the Black Legion. And he was a reactionary commissioner, wasn't very interested in defending the rights of people to organize. And so when a person turned up dead with a bullet hole to the head and some union applications tucked under his torso, he wasn't inclined to have it investigated. All right, we're in Ann Arbor. 1935, May 1935.
All right. Jesse
Owens at Ferry Field. All right, so if you're a progressive-minded person in 1935, and you're looking for some reason to feel optimistic about race relations, there's two young African-American athletes that might give you some hope. And they're pictured up in the left corner. One is Joe Lewis, of course, and the other is the junior from Ohio State University who comes into Ann Arbor in May 1935 and within an hour's time sets three track world records and ties a fourth within 1 hour's time. And you could look to these two athletes because they not only had black fans, they also had white fans cheering for him, and perhaps your spirits could be lifted by that fact. There are thousands of people at Ferry Field. Granted, it was a U of M audience, so they're probably not rooting crazily for Ohio State, but nonetheless, they realize that they're witnessing history, and among those in the audience that day is Gerald Ford, a future president, who just finished his last season playing football for the Wolverines. So you could look to that moment, but then later that evening in Pinckney, 25 miles from here, there's something that would bring you back down to earth. And it was that there was a gathering of Black Legionnaires there. And the local colonel of the regiment that Dayton Dean was a big part of, a guy named Colonel Harry Davis, who also worked at the Mastursky power plant, got in his idea, hit a dozen guys, they were having a drinking party out at Rush Lake, got it into his head that he wanted to know what it would feel like to kill a black man just for fun. And so they lure Silas Coleman, a World War I vet, out to Rush Lake. He's driven out there by Dayton Dean and another legionnaire. And he's told that they're going to help him collect some back wages from somebody who owes him money, that he's up here having a party. And all three of them supposedly are owed money by this guy. And they go out to Rush Lake, and Harry Davis, you know, quietly outside of earshot of Silas Coleman, tells his buddies, "We're going to have some fun, guys." And they take Silas Coleman out to the Ford Mill Pond, which was actually a much larger pond back in that day before, I guess, it flooded and got drained at some point in history. Still there, though. They take him out there, and they're looking supposedly for the guy who owes them money, who they say is at midnight out on the pond fishing. And Silas starts to suspect that something isn't quite right with this story, and he runs. And they hunt him down and kill him. This is May 1935. He had a petty record of some minor crimes, and so the Detroit police weren't all that interested in investigating this murder. And they just attributed it to his having done some other black guy wrong and, you know, got his retribution. So there was no investigation, really. It's not until a year later, when the Black Legion finally becomes exposed, that we learn that murder, as well as I mentioned, potentially another 50, were attributed. This is the murder that leads to the exposure of the Black Legion. This is a guy named Charlie Poole. And I showed you a picture of the Finletter Temple. Well, in May 1936, on one evening, there are Legionnaires gathered in the Finletter Temple. And Harry Davis is riling them up because he's telling them that Charlie Poole beat his wife, and his wife is in the hospital right now. Their baby has died, and we got to do something about this. Charlie Poole, in fact, had not beat his wife. It was a made-up story to enrage these Legionnaires who believed, you know, in a certain level of chivalry when it came to women. What had really happened was that Charlie Poole was a target because one of the Legionnaires back in Tennessee had fallen in love with the woman that he ended up marrying, Betsy Poole. And Betsy was a Baptist, Charlie was a Catholic. This guy that grew up with Betsy didn't like the idea that Charlie was married. He had hopes that he would get together with Betsy. So they hatched this whole story, and they lured Charlie Poole to his death, telling him, as was common in that time, that we have a job for you because you're a talented ball player. The industrial leagues in Detroit were very competitive. It was possible for you to get a job if you were a talented ball player. It was kind of a ringer. And Charlie was a catcher. He was a very good catcher. And so he thinks he's going to a meeting to get sized up for a uniform and that he's going to have a job at one of the plants along Fort Street there. And instead, he's taken out to Dearborn, to Gully Road, and he's assassinated. Now, sometimes those crimes get investigated, sometimes they don't in 1930s Detroit, depending on what police learn initially. In this case, the first detective out there looks at him and thinks, he looks kind of like one of the guys in the Purple Gang. And then somebody else comes and takes a look and says, nah, it's not him. But there had been a bank robbery a couple days prior, so he may still be a gangster. And this is the era when everybody in the 1934-35 is celebrating the FBI, the feds, right, the G-men, because they've taken care of Bonnie and Clyde and John Dellinger and Babyface Nilsson, and they're thinking this guy might be a gangster. So they send his fingerprints off, and a match comes back. He's not a gangster, but he did have a minor record for hopping a train back in Kansas City in the 20s. So the investigation has begun. And within a couple weeks' time, due to the honest police work of a couple guys, it's going to unravel. And it's going to come out that there's this secret society. And there's going to be hysteria because suddenly wives are realizing their husbands are members. People are finding out that the Wayne County prosecutor had signed a membership card, that Oakland County government is riddled with Black Legion members who didn't necessarily know about the killing that was taking place, but was using the Black Legion as a way to draw support and to get votes. There's so much hysteria that J. Edgar Hoover's getting flooded with letters demanding action, investigation. He's not inclined to do it. In fact, it's interesting as I'm reading through the FBI documents to see his signature down at the bottom of almost all these, not our area, can't investigate, not going to investigate, even when it's showing that one of the potential victims had been taken across international lines left at Fighting Island in Canada, across from Ecorse and Wyandotte. He scolds the FBI agent who had started to look into it, says, you don't have authority. But there's so much hysteria, and this is so much in the news, reporters coming from New York and D.C., the big name reporters from the major newspapers and the news services, the radio services, into the courtroom situation. And such a big deal that there are two movies that come out. Anybody recognize who's the star of this one? Well, actually, you can read who's the star of this one, right? So I'm not giving you a candy bar. So, there are plays, there are radio serials, there are novels that get based on the Black Legion. One of the amazing things to me as a researcher and author is why some stories, decades later, are celebrated and romanticized and remembered, and other ones fade, because in its day, the Black Legion was a massive story. And today, it's just you don't hear about it. So I'm not sure if it's because it came too close to what did overlap with Hitler's rise. So maybe it just became overwhelmed with the Hitler and World War II story. So I've taken you to this deep, dark place. I want to, before we do some questions, to take you to a happier moment, because happening at the same time, as I mentioned earlier, is this phenomenal sports success in Detroit. And chief among those folks that we're celebrating is Joe Louis, who had been born in Alabama, but grew up in Detroit, in the Black Bottom area, and is becoming in his early 20s, has become a national figure. No matter what he's doing, he's on the front page of the black newspapers. If he's dating somebody, if he's won a fight, if he buys a new car or gets a free one, he's on the front page of the black papers. He's also big news in the Detroit newspapers and nationally. A celebrity in Harlem, whenever he goes into a train station, the porters lift him up on their shoulders and carry him through. He's a big deal, and it's a positive story, right? Those of you who know your boxing history will know that Joe Louis wasn't, and he wouldn't become champion for a couple of years, but wasn't the first African-American to be the heavyweight champion.
Jack Johnson
was. And it was because of Jack Johnson's personality that Joe Louis did not get a shot at the title for a while. Jack Johnson was in your face. He taunted the guys that he beat. He'd be over the top of them. One of his defeats of Jim Jeffries resulted in race riots across the country. And so the powers that be decided there's not going to be another black guy who gets a shot for a long time. And the way Joe Louis got the shot is the PR stuff he had to do. He was basically a quiet individual, but a lot of it was also manufactured. He had rules that he had to follow. His management said, you can't be seen in public with a white woman. You can't be seen alone with any woman unless you're engaged. You have to be in a group. You are never to taunt an opponent. They faked pictures of him reading his Bible at camp, you know, just to enhance his image. And finally, he did get the shot. But this guy was a bigger name in Detroit in 1934 than Greenberg, Geringer, Cochran, or the third G-man, Goose Goslin. Those four guys went into the Hall of Fame. This guy didn't. But in 1934, he wins 11, 12, 13 straight games, 14, 15, 16 straight games, ties the American League record. The whole baseball world is talking about this country bumpkin guy from Arkansas, 6'5". I see some heads shaking. So anybody who's not answered a question, who has any idea who we're talking about here? So several of you have answered. And you know that this guy is Schoolboy Rowe. Schoolboy Rowe, after he wins his 16th straight game and doesn't win the 17th straight, his streak stops at 16, he goes on one of the highest rated radio shows in the nation. And of course, this is pre-TV, so radio's the big deal. It's the Rudy Valley Hour. And they've scripted some lines to play off his homie, attitude. He's a slow-speaking, kind of country-ish guy who has a whole box full of good luck trinkets that he caresses before every game, not just the rabbit's tail, but the jade elephant from China and the coins from the Netherlands and some lucky thing he found on the sidewalk in Canada once. And they've scripted a couple lines for him, and the line, and a version of this is going to follow him for the rest of his life. The line is, "Hello, Ma. Hello, Edna. How am I doing?" Simple. Edna's his high school sweetheart. They're going to get married after the season in 1934. And instantly, that line gets reduced to, "How am I doing, Edna?" Whenever he appears on a ball field for the rest of his career, and it will last 15 years, people are going to be yelling to him about Edna. And your opponents, you give up a home run, and he's like, "How the hell is she doing now, Edna?" And it irritated the heck out of him. But Edna becomes a front page columnist for the Detroit Times. She's at all the ball games, and Babe Ruth has to meet her, and the actors who are coming there, and Will Rogers, everybody wants to meet Edna. And it's a sweet love story that that runs through the book. And I talked with his grandkids, because Schoolboy died relatively young in his early 50s, around 1960, but Edna lived on for several decades more into the, I believe, the 1990s. And she never remarried because she was still in love with Linwood Schoolboy Rowe. And the kids, not kids anymore, they're my age, they inherited a box of all these trinkets, the jade elephant. They didn't know the meaning of all of them, but they also found among those, to reinforce this love story, they found all of his love notes that he used to write to Edna, because every time he'd leave the house, he'd write Edna some kind of love note. Didn't have all of them, but good deal of them. So anyway, I thought we should kind of conclude on a positive, uplifting story, since we've been spending, and I've been spending the last several years with the deadly Black Legion. And you have to be prepared to do that when you work on a book like this, because you're going to live with these miserable people. I feel good in one respect. I feel like finally, after all these years, some of these people who committed these crimes actually got their punishment. There were about 20 people who went to jail as part of the Black Legion trials. And there were really only two murder trials, one around the death of Silas Coleman and one around the death of Charlie Poole. All the other murders they got away with. The vow of secrecy held. People did not testify. When Bert Effinger was finally, 3 years later, through the work of one police captain in Michigan, Ira Marmon, who just kept pushing and pushing and pushing and wanted the FBI to investigate, wouldn't happen. Kept pushing nonetheless. They finally brought Bert Effinger back to Detroit. He had been hiding, being protected by the police and government agencies in Ohio. He had been living like in his same house, but was underground. And finally, he comes back to Michigan several years after all the other trials, and they can't get anybody to testify. Everybody who's supposed to testify disappears or suddenly doesn't remember anything. And my theory is simply that there was a massive cover-up that took place to avoid tainting the political careers of a lot of people. One of the people, and I'm not contending that this man was a member of the Black Legion, I don't know that, but a gentleman who ran for U.S. Senate that in 1936 in the Republican primary. Some of you are familiar with Cousins Street in Detroit? Well, that's James Cousin and his son Frank Cousin, who was the mayor of Detroit at the time. James Cousin was the U.S. Senator Republican who was siding with FDR on some issues, and he ended up with, think of it as like a Tea Party challenge. He ended up with a challenge from the right in the Republican primary. And the guy who challenged him was a former governor, Wilbur Brucker, who ended up announcing his candidacy at a meeting of one of the Black Legion Front organizations. And William Brucker went on to become, under President Eisenhower, the Secretary of the U.S. Army. At the time, he was tainted by the Black Legion. They never came up in his hearings. Anyway, I could ramble on here. Anybody have any questions? I think there's a microphone at the back.
So I have a microphone. If you would please raise your hand, we'd like to get your question on film. Thank you.
Yeah, we are filming.
Very good talk. Thank you.
Thank you.
Because the Tigers had never won the World Series, how would you characterize the mood or the psyche of the Tigers fans in those 2 years?
Oh, it was crazy. I mean, leading up to the 1934 series, and actually their team was record-wise better in 1934. And we go into the World Series in 34. They're playing the St. Louis Cardinals. Boy, I'm trying to think of a non-sports question because I'm throwing the same candy bars out. Who are led by a pitcher?
Dizzy Dean.
I don't know where to. I'm going to throw a candy bar to you. Oh, sorry. Dizzy Dean. And the Tigers are supposed to win that World Series. They end up losing it miserably in the final game. The day before, one of the players had spiked a Detroit Tiger. Ducky Medwick of the Cardinals spiked Marvone. And they couldn't continue the game. They almost had to forfeit it because the fans at Navin Field, which would become Tiger Stadium later, were whipping things, bottles, apples, pies at Ducky Medwick, just tons of it. And the city was demoralized because they lost that game, and the next day, the final game of the World Series, they lose it. And we went from this incredible high to this incredible low. And then in 1935, we do it all over again. Mickey Cochran takes the team to the World Series this time, and they win it, and the city is just nuts. In fact, when they unveil the pennant on the Hudson's Building, you know, before the World Series, you know, this 8-story pennant, and Mickey Cochran's young daughter pushes the button that results in this flag going down the side of the Hudson Building. There are 100,000 people in the streets in Detroit cheering that on. And so it is a massive, massive thing. When the Lions win, it's not nearly as big of a deal because NFL football is not even, people aren't even sure whether the best NFL team can beat the best college team. It's just a shadow of what it's become. The Wings victory was a massive deal. But by the time the Lions win their championship, the newspapers are talking about the city of champions because no other city, once the Red Wings win, no other city in history, either before or since, has won those three championships within one season. And hopefully, I don't know, are we in danger of Pittsburgh doing it or something? They keep calling themselves the city of champions. But any other questions? If you raise your hand, this one up here.
I presume that the Legion of Doom no longer exists, the Black Legion?
Well, I presume so too. Nothing's happened to my house yet, so haven't received any death threats. But, you know, I don't know. Is there some other version of some secret society? I'd like to think that in this day and age that even though there are people who may have those same hatreds, that you wouldn't be able to organize a group of tens of thousands of people secretly. I mean, there are still versions of the Klan, I guess, right? I don't know that we're really attributing murders to them at this point. So I wouldn't, you know, I don't think. Bert Effinger tried to reorganize the Black Legion because once it got exposed, people ran for cover. They were burning their outfits, throwing them into swamps. They may still be some that turned up in somebody's attic. So if you end up, hopefully you don't end up with find out that your great-grandfather had passed on this outfit that really wasn't, a fraternity organization in the sweet sense. I held one of the outfits at the Reuther Library at Wayne State University where they have some large archives related to the Black Legion, and it's not all that well made. It's just kind of, you know, somebody made it in their kitchen kind of thing. But
Tom, but go back to the Lions. It is truly fascinating how football, professional football, was not really that big of a deal at all compared to what it is now. Where were the Lions playing?
Do you know the answer to that? I'll give you the candy bar.
No, that's not fair.
Okay, all right, okay. Anybody know where somebody in the back knows where the Lions were playing?
Yeah.
U of D. Okay, we're going to try a long throw.
Yeah.
Here,
so.
Didn't hit anybody, right?
Broken in a convenient piece.
They played at the University of Detroit at McNichols and Livernois. At the U of D football stadium, U of D, about 12,000, and the Lions didn't fill it most of the time. And I don't think they filled it for their championship game either, but that is where the tradition of the Thanksgiving Day football game, in Detroit anyway, took shape at the U of D field. And so in that era, you couldn't even make a living just playing football professionally. You'd get... Well, the Lions tried to sign Gerald Ford. He turned them down so he could go be, an assistant coach at Yale and eventually get his law degree there. But you might get a contract. I think they offered him $200, $250 for the season, something like that. It wasn't enough to make a living at. The baseball players did better, but still a lot of them had winter jobs. Until the Depression hit, Charlie Gehringer worked in the offseason at Hudson's. You know, selling things. He owned a couple of gas stations. A lot of the guys parlayed their fame, as they do now, into other sources of income. So, Goose Goslin went on a tour. A lot of them did barnstorming in the off season, taking their teams with some other stars to small towns.
Was there radio in 1935? Was the World Series broadcast?
Yeah, they were
who were the announcers?
Yeah, they were competing. Anybody know who the announcers were?
Tom?
Ty Tyson? Ty Tyson was one. And Harry Heilman. Harry Heilman was just starting out then, former Tiger. So they were competing. I think one of them handled the city and one handled the outstate. But they were on competing stations. So we had two radio announcers. And
what were the state? Were they JR?
You know, I believe it was WJR and WXYZ, I believe. Because WXYZ at that time had, did I get that wrong or did I? Was it WWJ?
Yeah.
Okay, so sorry, WWJ. But WXYZ, I think, had at that stage a big show that was becoming incredibly popular nationwide, originating from Detroit.
Lone Ranger.
The Lone Ranger. Very good. Out of candy bars, I think. So, but yeah, so radio was in its heyday. In fact, that 1935 World Series, does anybody know who the broadcaster, what the Chicago Cubs announcer was at that 1935 World Series?
No, that's a good one.
And you know him better because he became a president of the United States.
Reagan
was the announcer.
Really?
Yeah. Red Barber was broadcasting his first World Series, and in the seats, as Martin knows, because he actually bought at an auction a ticket, was a teenage Ernie Harwell, whose uncle in Chicago had bought him tickets to go to that World Series. So,
more questions? I got a couple
good?
More, but
or,
I don't want to impinge on your questions. More questions for Tom, please. Take us into the celebration. I'm just so fascinated when the Tigers won this first World Series in 1935. What was it like? What did your research tell you? And I'm also fascinated, maybe, I don't know if everyone knows, there were three daily newspapers in Detroit, the News, the Free Press, and?
Detroit Times.
Yeah.
Run by, anybody know who owned the Detroit Times back then? William Randolph Hearst. Who, of course, if you don't know Hearst, you do know movies, you know that Citizen Kane was loosely based on William Randolph Hearst and his evil ways, I guess you could say, right? But yeah, my memory tells me that there was an election that was to take place the day after the Tigers won. And so actually on the day that they won World Series, they tried to convince people that they couldn't be drinking. They used to have a law that you couldn't drink prior to election day because they didn't want you voting drunk.
Really?
And it didn't work real well because people were celebrating. They were in downtown. And one of the major areas of celebration was the Washington Boulevard area where you had the premier hotels, including the Book Cadillac. And so the parties were out there. When the games were taking place in Chicago, there were huge trucks broadcasting in various parks in parts of the city. And as my dad told me, they were broadcasting at his school too, because the game started at, yeah, they were all day games before lights, and they lasted rarely more than 2 hours, sometimes an hour and a half.
And how much would a World Series ticket cost?
What would that have cost? That's a good question. I think about a buck, you know.
World Series.
Yes, for the World Series, yeah. So that sounds like a good place to come. I don't want to keep stop. I don't want to keep you guys here too long, but it's been a pleasure talking to you. I know they're selling books in the back. I'd be happy to sign anybody if they're interested.
Yeah, Thomas, interested. Yeah, there's books available in back. One more question before you run. You got to mention the book that you wrote about the Tigers final year at Tiger Stadium, which is an acclaimed book and still in print.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it was 15 years ago this spring. My first major book was The Final Season, which is a memoir of the last year at Tiger Stadium, mainly about father sons and my relationship with my dad and my relationship with my heroes, Al Kaline and Ernie Harwell and Willie Horton and a variety of other people I met that year. Huh?
Your heroes.
My heroes, yes. Nobody else, right? As I tell audiences when I used to tour for the final season in other states, that, you know, Al Kaline, for any kid who grew up in the 50s, 60s, or early 70s and was a baseball fan, he was like our baseball god. But in actuality, I worshipped Mickey Lolich more. Because Kaline, he was a god, and I loved Kaline, but he always seemed like he was on another level to me.
Sure.
He was like beyond our reach. Whereas Mickey Lolich had a pot belly, and he looked like... What's that?
Ate a lot of donuts.
Made donuts later on. Ate donuts. He looked like the kind of guy who'd fit in our blue-collar neighborhood where I grew up in Warren. You could see him changing his oil in the driveway and, you know, squirting lighter fluid into the coals of a hot dog pit, you know. So, loved Mickey Lovich.
We were at that last game also. We were at that last game, and I remember the fan reception for the old-timers that came out. And was Eldon Ocker on the 35 team?
He was. Eldon Ocker.
He was there.
He was.
And he got it. And the ovation showed that there were enough people there that had a memory. I know that a World Series has a half-life in Detroit, whether it's 20 years or whatever. You know, we're still living off the 84 World Series.
I was standing next to my dad. And those of you who remember that final game, they had the players running out to their old positions as the music from The Natural is playing. And they're not introducing them by name. It's just a silent procession. And I'm standing next to my dad, who at that point was nearly 80. And he's watching Eldon Ocker, who when I was little, he used to play catch with me in the backyard. And my dad, not Eldon Ocker, and he would emulate Eldon Ocker's motion, which was underhand, because he had hurt his shoulder when he was a Colorado quarterback. And so I'm standing next to my dad, and instantly I'm flashing back to when I'm 11 years old playing catch with my dad in the yard, and he's watching this guy that he idolized, and my dad's already an old man, and it was, everybody in that stadium was in tears, I think, in the final thing. So thank you very much for coming out. I appreciate
it. City of Champions. Please grab a book. Hey.